8 minutes after 8 on Friday, September 23rd, and that means it's time for the Week in Review. I'm Dean Kallenbach, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm glad to be with you this morning as we talk about a very newsy week. As is our wont on these Fridays at 8, we'll bring in two guests who are likely to give us some civil discourse and different perspectives on the big issues of the past week. As always, your thoughts and comments are welcome. Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send your email to talk@wpr.org. You can tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show, and you can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Later, of course, in the hour, you can play the Week in Review quiz as well. Looking forward to that. Kevin Hermaning of Mosinee is a political analyst and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, also owner of Hermaning Financial Group and Hermaning Advisory Services in Wausau. Kevin Hermaning, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the invitation to join you today.
John Smart of Park Falls is a board member on the Wisconsin Alliance for Excellent Schools and former chair of the Price County Democratic Party. John Smart, good to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. And Kevin, good to talk to you again.
Good morning to you as well, John. It's an interesting thing when they still talk about us as former chairs. It's been a few years.
I don't know. I've retired to vice chair. How about you?
There you go. Just an activist and very involved.
Okay.
Well, I think you've been branded is what's happening, branded for life. Well, Kevin Herman, I'm going to start with you because, to me, the big story that's hitting the headlines this morning is the fear of a new global recession. The stock market has pretty much lost all of the gains it had had for 2011 by the end of yesterday. And with your perspective as a financial planner, I would think that you're paying pretty close attention to that. How about this global recession? Kevin Hermaning started out, how worried are you about this?
Well, there is a lot of fear about a possible double dip. But I think really the big story is the real problem still going on in the European area. The banks over there are very extended to countries such as Greece and Italy and Ireland and, of course, Portugal and Spain, what we refer to as the pigs countries. And you're right. Actually, we hit a 52-week low, meaning we're back where we were last year at this time in late September. So it'll be an interesting story to watch as the markets open here in another 20 minutes or so, and whether they'll follow some of what happened overseas overnight. But perhaps we'll see a little bit of resiliency. I see that the group of 20 countries really came up overnight and said they're not going to let Europe fail. So that should maybe put a little bit of a floor under things.
John Smart, any thoughts on that?
I would echo pretty much what Kevin said, and I'm glad that that we're not pointing to the United States as being in any way, well, in any way, we're a part of the international market, of course, but that it's not our fault. You know, that's what too often we hear from the talking heads on television and talk radio.
Oh, fault or not, we're certainly affected by it, and I'm wondering, it's a little bit of a dicey situation as tight as the U.S. Credit situation is with the recent downgrade and, of course, the discussion about deficit reduction, which we'll get into yet, is there more danger, I guess, because we're dealing with both Europe in a financial crisis and the U.S. not in such a great position either. Maybe not as bad as Europe, but certainly vulnerable.
Well, we're definitely vulnerable because you're right. We do trade in an international marketplace, whether it's consumer goods or some of the things such as the main two commodities that are denominated globally in U.S. dollars. Those being oil, a barrel of oil, and an ounce of gold. They're definitely, all of this is affecting the U.S. economy. It's dragging down the stock market. It's really sapping confidence on the part of the American people. The housing market you know, interestingly enough, has actually seen a little bit of a firming up over the last 4 months. Two mornings ago, it was announced that housing prices actually went up, although very, very minimally, but they went up for the fourth month in a row. And I think the Fed is kind of flailing around. I'm absolutely not a defender of Bernanke, and I was extremely critical over many, many years of Greenspan, who always seemed to be coming late to the party. And, you know, suddenly he starts speaking English rather than Greenspan speak many years ago, after everybody already knew what was going on. Clearly, the SEC has been at fault. They missed the Madoff fiasco. They were not doing a very diligent job in monitoring what was going on over at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But the good news is, and I have not been a defender of banks over the years in our country, but the great news is that the banks in the U.S. are not very heavily burdened at all with what's going on in Europe. It's my understanding that only 3% of bank loans on the part of U.S.-based banks are extended to some of the falling powers over in Europe.
John Smart, how about the Federal Reserve's twist this week, this effort to ease interest rates without actually lowering the interest rate? Haven't seen much of an effect yet. Should the Fed do more?
I don't know, but I think that the Fed gets blamed for an awful lot of things, and I'm not sure that they have total control over anything either. Kevin just said that he's not very fond of Bernanke, and he wasn't very fond of his predecessors either. And I think that kind of points up the fact that we rely too much on the Federal Reserve. We say, well, they should be able to pull us out of this. Going back to the original discussion about the international, the global aspects of all of this, I think that this just points it up. We are truly in a global economy, much more so than we ever were before. We've heard this phrase over and over again that we must think globally and so forth, but everything that happens anywhere, whether it happens in Shanghai or Lisbon, it affects the international markets, and everything affects everything, and everything causes something else to happen. And I think more than ever before, we have to consider ourselves as part of a global enterprise rather than just an independent country.
Well, let's shift to a different subject. Some more breaking news from last night, actually. Here's reading from the Washington Post. A day after defeating a virtually identical bill, the U.S. House has passed a temporary spending measure to fund the government through November 18th by a vote of 219 to 203 after Republican leaders included a new spending cut to lure conservative votes. The measure is now on a collision course with the Democratic-led Senate, which believes the bill does not do enough for disaster victims, raising a new specter of a government shutdown when the fiscal year ends at the end of next week. John Smart, your response to what's happening relating to trying to plug that gap on getting a spending measure, getting a budget that we can have for more than a couple of months at a time.
Well, now we're getting into politics
Instead
of international finance. I never thought I would ever say this, but I actually feel sorry for John Boehner. I think he's in a terribly difficult position trying to balance the various aspects of his own party and form the House into some kind of a functioning organization. And it's really difficult. I mean, as you read from the Washington Post, was it? That this bill that was passed last night in the dark of the night was almost identical to the one that was rejected before. And I think it's really kind of a sad state that we're in. And I'm sorry that we're in this situation where we're operating, you know, a month-by-month basis. It's not healthy, and it's not a good idea.
Kevin Hermaning.
Well, both parties have, I think on Politico this morning, it was described in the Democratic caucus last night as very stormy. And clearly, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, was trying to recover from his admittedly stinging loss on Wednesday when 48 of his colleagues abandoned him, deserted him, whatever way you want to say, and said, we're not going to spend the money unless we have an offsetting cut elsewhere. You know, I think some of the I'm not aware of anybody who is unwilling to support and lend emergency relief to people who are deserving victims of calamities such as the big hurricane and some of the other things that have happened over many years, but certainly this year with Hurricane Irene. And that's really what a lot of this is about. But what fails, interestingly enough, this time to get a lot of the headlines is a lot of the resources that are going to be spent by the American people in helping the flood victims and the hurricane victims, they're going to go to these folks who have gone out and built these huge mansions on the coastlines, and then they are surprised or sickened by the fact that their multi-million-dollar dream house is wiped out by a hurricane, and then they expect the American people to come and bail them out. That is just wrong. And that needs to be enunciated a little bit more by the leaders in the House and in the Senate and say, listen, if you're going to take on this kind of risk and you're going to go in these locations, you're on your own. The American people should not be taxed to bail out the folks who make ridiculous decisions.
That's Kevin Hermaning. John Smart is with us as well. It's our Week in Review. And as long as we're talking about that House bill, let's have Ned from Wausau join us to talk about same. Ned, thanks for joining us on the Week in Review.
Yes, thank you very much. Just a comment about last night's vote in the House. What I had heard on the news, perhaps this is the case, that the funding for the disaster relief appears to be matched, sounds like dollar for dollar, by cuts primarily to environmental programs. And I strongly oppose that type of approach. That is just ridiculous. You know, the majority of American people support environmental protection in various programs. And, you know, the greatest waste anywhere in our government, according to most observers, is in the Defense Department. There is so much waste. They've cited several this week, in fact, examples that are just ridiculous.
And so Kevin Hermaning, Ned says, you Republicans aren't too fond of the environment.
Well, and I would say that that's patently inaccurate. But what Republicans and a lot of non-Republicans, I would submit Democrats and independents, get tired of is putting the interests of the darter snail ahead of the interests of commercial development, residential development, home building and small businesses, hiring employees. My understanding of what was really going on last night had more to do with cuts from the alternative energy programs, and given the fiasco with Solyndra and some of the other so-called green jobs providers over the years, I think it was probably a good decision. But that's my understanding. When I read the Post or the Times or the Journal Sentinel today, it references the alternative energy programs. It does not, in fact, reference energy environmental programs. I would think that lots of people would say, well, alternative energy programs do or are good for the environment, and so maybe that's where they're stretching it. But I'm not aware of anybody who wants dirty water to drink and a poor living condition in which to raise their kids.
Well, I haven't heard the snail darter brought up in a long time, Kevin. That's kind of interesting.
You know what? I hadn't either, but I pulled it out of the comment from the debate last night down in Florida. One of the candidates brought that up last night.
I know. I heard it, too. I thought that was pretty funny. What I think that the danger in this, and going back to the original question, the danger in this is people in the House of Representatives holding disaster relief hostage to their own particular direction that they want to follow on cuts in the budget, and I just think that that's a mistake. I think that we, as a nation, we are much more compassionate than that, and the first thought should be for people who desperately need help. And I agree with Kevin regarding people that that build big mansions in floodplains and so forth and so on. That's stupid.
John,
Where
would you propose they get the money from if we're going to offset the new spending on disaster relief, which I think we should at some point, America has to have a philosophical discussion about whether it is the responsibility of the federal government to take care of people who become victims of natural disasters. I don't think there's anything that's constitutional about that whatsoever anyway.
It's a very interesting point, Kevin. And if you listen to the Republicans in the debates, they're talking about how the churches should pick that up, and everybody should be more concerned about their own relatives and so forth. That just doesn't work, you know. We've tried that. I remember long stories that my mother would tell about what it was like in the United States back in the Depression, and how when Social Security came along and a few other things like that, that it solved a lot of problems for people who were in desperate straits. And that's the situation that we're dealing with now. It's not like, well, let's see, we've got a major damage from a hurricane. Let's see if we can get some churches to come together and donate money to help these poor people. We haven't got time for that. We really need to consider this as something that we have to do as a nation.
Actually, I don't think that that's true at all, John. My daughter, who's a student out at Liberty University out in Virginia, she actually is going on a bus either this or the following weekend up to Albany, New York, where she and a bunch of her colleagues and people from all around the country are converging on that part of the country to on the most desperate places in our country who are suffering to take care of a lot of those needs. That's the cleanup, the housing of people, the providing of foodstuffs, the support from a financial perspective. That is what charity is all about.
That is indeed, and I agree with you, and I applaud your daughter for doing that.
But government,
but I don't think that as a nation
charity.
We can depend on that.
Government cannot replace charity.
We are on the Week in Review, and I think we're done talking about snail darters, but we will come back and talk about that Republican debate after the break. John Smart of Park Falls is a board member of the Wisconsin Alliance for Excellent Schools, former chair of the Price County Democratic Party. Kevin Hermaning of Mosinee is a political analyst, former chair of Marathon County Republican Party, and owner of the Hermaning Financial Group. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to join this discussion. Send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardin Show Facebook page. I'm Dean Kallenbach, in for Joy Cardin, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 26 minutes after 8 o'clock. I'm Dean Kallenbach, in for Joy Cardin on the Ideas Network. After three on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, it's Food Friday. Jean Faraca and her guests discussed eating smart in France and how to eat and drink like a local. Back now to our Week in Review. Our guests are Kevin Hermaning, a political analyst and former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, and former Price County Democratic Party chair, John Smart of Park Falls. And we promised to talk about the Republican presidential debate last night, and the thing I observed is suddenly there are two more candidates in that debate, the second Rick Perry and the second Mitt Romney. Gentlemen, and John Smart, let's start with you, your response to last night's debate that was sponsored, I believe, by Fox.
It was indeed sponsored by Fox, which was very evident throughout the
and Google
evening. And I thought it was interesting. But not nearly as devastating as the previous one. The one before really scared me when they were talking about death penalty and things like that, and the audience cheered. And when people talked, when they were talking about somebody who could not afford health care and was dying, they cheered. It was like, kill them. And that scared me. The one last night I didn't think was quite so. It was more of a replay of the one before, and I guess I didn't think anything terribly exciting came out of it, except that John Huntsman comes across more and more as a rational person.
Kevin Hermaning, your thoughts on last night's debate?
Well, I did watch most of the debate, at least the second half, and a little bit more than that. But, you know, John Huntsman did a great job, no question about it. There were a few one-liners that I thought were pretty good. I liked what Gary Johnson had to say about the shovel-ready jobs and his neighbor's dog creating more shovel-ready jobs than the Obama administration has over 2 years. And but, you know, it appears that some of these guys are either running for vice president or running for president next time. And presumably that would be in 8 years, or I guess nine, really. It still, I think, remains a two-man race with a few people kind of hanging in there really well and strong. you know, Newt Gingrich has always been a favorite of conservatives who saw him take on the Democrat establishment way back in 1994. It's a long time ago, but he continues to be one of the best thinkers of the party has, a good policy guy, but I don't think he can get it done at this stage. It's getting kind of late for him. And again, it still appears that it's a Perry-Romney battle. I would submit that it's very possible that all the candidates are not yet in. With Obama's numbers continuing to fall, particularly in the battleground states, there are some candidates who maybe still are on the sidelines who are looking at it saying, you know what, there's an opportunity to step in. The Republican voters, the primary voters, the people who make the difference on in the primary process, in the primaries, they don't seem to be fully connected and fully locked into who their first choices are. And so you could see a late entrant. You also could see some change in some of the post-debate discussion last night, and polling showed that.
And Kevin Hermaning, I'm curious, as a Republican, one of the kind of the image that comes through my mind as I watch this very early Republican presidential contest, I mean, months before the first election of any sort or caucus, it makes me think of that arcade game Whack-A-Mole. They just keep pounding each other. And, you know, who wouldn't be wise to stay out of this fray until the last minute if they could do it? I mean, you're contending it's a two-person race, and Rick Perry and Mitt Romney spent all their time pretty much talking to each other last night and kind of affirming that. Is this damaging to their general election opportunity down the line if they keep talking about how bad the other one is?
Your question kind of suggests a lot of short memory on a lot of people's parts, because I hear that quite a bit. 4 years ago at this time, the Republican Party primary process, Huckabee and Giuliani were in the lead. McCain was an afterthought, and Giuliani and Romney were in the lead. Huckabee came on strong and won Iowa, and of course then disappeared shortly thereafter. And McCain was an afterthought at this time 4 years ago. Of course, as it turned out, McCain ended up losing the general election. We all know that. But the Democrats are at least as good at beating up one another during a primary process. Remember the 3 a.m. ad that Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama and some of the others? And it appears to me that that actually helps to strengthen the general election nominee. That helps to kind of this process helps people sharpen their comments, sharpen and become more resilient in being able to debate and address important issues, to bone up on the important policy issues of the day, whether domestic or international. Clearly, when you talk about governors running for president, governors have, by default, less foreign policy experience than somebody who has either served, such as John mentioned, Governor Huntsman, who served as ambassador to China, but is nowhere at all polling in any kind of a polling statistical result that could ever give John Huntsman an opportunity to become president this go-around. But you're seeing some of these guys become a little bit more familiar with those issues that are going to become more important by next year at this time.
John Smart, do you agree with Kevin Hermaning? It's a two-person race at this point with the candidates who have declared, and does it really matter which one wins? Because isn't Obama vulnerable enough that either one of them would beat him anyway?
Well, first of all, the primary system that we have is not a place for wusses. I mean, it's going to be rough no matter what. And yes, Hillary and Barack Obama went at each other tooth and nail, and yes, they're going at it now. I think it's probably a little early to determine whether or not we're talking about a two-man race in this case, or whether Michelle Bachmann ought to be considered, or whether anybody else should be considered. But it's a very interesting debate that they're having, and it's well worth paying attention to. I am very pleased to hear more and more about them. As I keep saying, John Huntsman keeps coming across as a far more moderate, far more experienced, and certainly with international experience, which appeals to me in particular, than anybody else on their particular stage. But it keeps changing, so who knows what's going to happen next.
Yeah, you know, talking about some of the other people up there, such as Michelle Bachmann, but also former Senator Rick Santorum, he doesn't, it appears, stand a chance to become president, but he is positioning himself as an international foreign policy expert. He's an excellent analyst when it comes to economic policy, and it would not be surprising to me at all if there isn't serious consideration given to the former senator from Pennsylvania when the vice president's sweepstakes begin, or veepstakes, as they call them. But a lot of people are suggesting that Senator Marco Rubio kind of has the inside track in that area.
Well, so it's far, Marco Rubio has said that he won't do it, and that'll be interesting to watch. But as a Democrat, I would be perfectly delighted if Rick Santorum was on the ticket.
Of course you would.
It's our week in review here on Wisconsin.
That's why we're glad that Obama's on the ballot next year.
It's our week in review on Wisconsin Public Radio's Joy Cardine Show. I'm Dean Kallenbach, sitting in for Joy. John Smart of Park Falls is a former chair of the Price County Democratic Party. He joins the fray here, and as does Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. Let's move on to some other news of the week, if we may. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is no longer in effect. Kevin Hermaning, former Marine, what do you think of that and the fact that it went out with something of a whimper?
Which issue?
Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, you know, it has gone out somewhat as a almost in a whimpering manner, but the reality is that the president... And I realize we operate in our country under civilian leadership. I get that. I respect it a lot. But historically, the presidents have seemed to take a lot more advice from generals than this president has. And, you know, the people who have led our country into battle and have won some of the important battles of the last 20 years and in this war on terror seem to have been kind of given short shrift. And it appears to me that the politicians are not in the military, the political people in the military, more so than probably since the worst days of Vietnam, now seem to have the upper hand and are kind of kowtowing to the civilian leadership rather than saying, listen, this is really important. And I think as some of the candidates, or at least one or two of the candidates last night said, who are running for president against Barack Obama, they would not penalize anybody who has already come out, but they would try to go back to the way it was, where sex is not an issue in the service, in the sense that you just don't talk about it.
Yeah, I understand that, and I've heard that too. Sex is not a matter of anybody's interest, except that it was, because thousands and thousands of people were ejected from the service because of it. My point on all of this, and I think it covers a whole lot of area, is that young people today, and I'm talking about, you know, people in their teens and 20s, don't really care about anybody's sexual orientation anymore. It really doesn't matter. And this is a fact that's going to be changing everybody's approach to a lot of different things, including Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it's just time to make that change. Other countries in the world have done this, have been working on this for a long time in their military forces. And it's time for the United States to catch up with the rest of the world to a large degree. But again, even on domestic issues regarding gay people, gays and lesbians, it no longer matters to the younger generation. If you get together a group of young people who are in their teens and 20s and ask them whether it matters to them at all, one way or the other, whether somebody is gay, they will say, no, of course not. Who cares? And that's the way it's going to be. And the people who are fighting this are the people who simply are holding on to the old way. And it's not going to be that way any longer.
It's our week in review. Let's move on to talk about the death penalty. Two executions this week caught some national attention. One in Georgia in particular drew protests. John Smart, any thoughts on the future of the death penalty?
I hope it's over. Troy Davis said himself that if his death means anything, it would be that we would end the idea of the death penalty. If you look at a list, it's very interesting. There's a list that you can find online about what countries in the world still have the death penalty. And we're right up there with China and North Vietnam and Yemen and Saudi Arabia, what we consider to be our partners in the world, our allies in the world, have long since done away with the death penalty, and it's far past time for us to do the same thing. And if this awful death of Troy Davis has any effect whatsoever, I hope that it will bring us closer to the end of it in the United States, despite what Rick Perry says and the people who were cheering in his audience.
Kevin Hermaning, your thoughts on the death penalty?
Well, and I think it's important to talk about the death penalty in general rather than personalizing and talking about any particular individual who may or may not have been guilty or eventually, in Troy Davis's case, was put to death the other day. And, of course, there's relevance and importance in that. And I do understand and I respect the fact that there are some Republican or conservative U.S. legal experts who do support capital punishment who were troubled by what happened in this case and some of the evidence. And I get that. I understand. But to the issue of the death penalty, clearly the Republican Party platform continues to advocate for, and I happen to support this particular plank in it, the death penalty. What a lot of people resent and reject is the lengthy process that is costly and allows the recanting of testimony and supposedly newfound evidence. Oftentimes, people have become get to the point where they have guilty consciences, not because they have been inaccurate in their testimony, but they suddenly change their own mind on whether or not they believe the death penalty is a proper penalty, proper judgment. And John, you're right. I've heard the castigating of our country because we're comparable to Iran and North Korea and some of the others because we support the death penalty. But there are a very limited number of the most heinous crimes that are used in some states that the death penalty is used for punishment. And just, you know, like the states' rights issues that are so important to so many conservatives, there are some states that, you know, if you're going to do certain things, you're going to behave a certain way, you're going to commit a certain crime, you better hope it wasn't in a particular state such as Texas or in Georgia.
Gentlemen, Dave from Wanakee would like to weigh in on this issue. Dave, welcome to the Week in Review.
Yes, hello. Listening to Mr. Hermaning, I can hear it, you know, in the way he talks about it, that what is most important is that somebody die. It doesn't necessarily have to be the person who actually committed the crime, but the person who was convicted has to die. Doesn't really matter if they actually committed the crime, just as long as, you know, a jury convicted them of it.
Do you want to respond, Kevin Hermaning?
Well, actually, I think that's exactly the opposite of how I feel. But I do think any time you're going to talk about any issue of public policy, you need to remove a particular individual from the debate and the discussion. These kinds of debates and discussions about whether capital punishment should be used as a matter of punishment in the U.S. and in any particular state should happen exclusive of any discussion about a particular person. And that way it depersonalizes it. I completely believe that this caller has mischaracterized what I believe. I don't believe that at all. I think that the judicial system has numerous opportunities for appeal. And somebody who is innocent should not be put to death. Somebody who's innocent shouldn't have even been convicted of a crime to begin with.
I think and that the governor of Illinois put that in very well. The last governor of Illinois, when he stopped the death penalty in that state, because he said any time that there is any question whatsoever for the state to murder somebody when they're not absolutely positively sure, and in the case of Troy Davis, obviously they were not absolutely positively sure, and I don't think we can leave it up to the states. I don't think we can leave it up to anybody. I think it, as it says in the Bible, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. It's not somebody else's responsibility to do that, to take a life.
Let's continue with some other stories in the news this week. Hiker's release has been negotiated against the backdrop of tension between Washington and Tehran. Shane Bauer and Josh Vital finally out of the prison in which they sat for quite a while in Iran. And Kevin Hermaning, you would certainly have a perspective on this, having spent 444 days as a prisoner in Iran, as one of the hostages captured in the late 70s. What was your response when you heard that these folks were coming home?
Well, I'm very glad that they were finally able to get out of the country. I'm glad for their families. I hope that their family members can actually ask them after the proper period of rejoicing, what in the heck were you hiking on the Iranian border for to begin with? But this is pretty much what the Iranians do. The Iranians, they'll scuttle across another country's border, and they'll kidnap some foreigners. In this case, three Americans, the two guys who were just freed, and one of their fiancés, Sarah, last year, Sarah Shroud, I think her name was. They've paid. It's all about extracting money, ransom. That's what this is all about, is a way to embarrass foreign countries. In this case, once again, it was the United States. It's not always the U.S., by the way. A couple of years ago, a bunch of British sailors were kidnapped at sea by the Iranian Navy. This is what the Iranians do. They do not live by under international law. The Iranians are part of the international, one of the countries that are a state sponsor of international terrorism, and they're just not peaceful players on the world stage. Ahmadinejad is in New York right now, speaking at the United Nations. And once again, we're going to hear these ridiculous stories that he's having thoughts and images of grandiosity, and he sees the second coming of the great imam. And again, this is what the Iranians do. But I'm grateful, and I'm glad that these hikers were finally able to get out of Iran, because if they had to spend 8 years in prison, in Evin prison, who knows what condition they might have found themselves in at that stage.
Gentlemen, quick thoughts on the Palestinian bid for statehood, as long as we're talking about the UN. President Obama said he'd veto it there. John Smart, is that a good call?
I think that the President of the United States is in the situation that he really cannot do anything else. But I have to say that I was disturbed that Prime Minister Netanyahu was congratulating him for supporting Israel and supporting peace, because I think that the Palestinians have waited quite long enough, and I think it's time for something to happen. And I don't blame them a bit for going before the United Nations and saying, please recognize us. They will not listen to us. And I think that the problem right now lies primarily in the government of Israel.
Agree, Kevin Hermaning?
No, absolutely not. I actually, last month, I spent 15 days in Israel, Egypt, Greece, Jordan, and Turkey, a full week in Israel. And it is an area of the world that continues to be of great importance to the possibility of peace in the Middle East. The Palestinians, largely with Hamas and Hezbollah and their backers in Damascus and Tehran, continue to foment the problems there. 36 Israelis were killed on a bus 2.5-3 weeks ago, and that's because there is so much going on right now in the Gaza Strip that is being backed by some of these things happening even now out of Egypt. I would say to you that this was a rare opportunity for the U.S. president to act statesmanlike, and he rose to the occasion. I do not congratulate this president on very much. I think he has done a terrible job at managing the U.S. economy, standing in the way. But in the area of standing up and saying that he will veto the unilateral move for Palestine to become a state, I think he did a great job.
It's our Week in Review. John Smart, political activist within the Democratic Party from Park Falls, is one of our guests. Kevin Hermaning, who you just heard there, of Mosinee, Republican, is our other. We will play the Week in Review quiz and come back to look at what's happening in the state of Wisconsin on a political front and in the news front right after our break. I'm Dean Collin, back in for Joy Cardine. This is the Wisconsin, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:50. I'm Dean Collin, back in for Joy Cardine on the Week in Review. Time now for the Week in Review quiz. We'll ask the question. You can call in with your guess, and we'll pick a winner from the correct answerers. The Milwaukee Brewers continue their push toward the playoffs tonight when they open up their final homestand of the regular season. It'll close out the regular season, actually, with six games. And because we all have a case of Brewers fever here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we want you to tell us the name of the team that became the Brewers upon relocating to Milwaukee. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or talk at WPR.org. And call or email in the next 5 minutes. We'll pick our winner in about that time. Let's move on now to continue our Week in Review with John Smart and Kevin Hermaning, and let's move to some statewide issues. A report this week found record spending in those Wisconsin recall elections from this summer. Kevin Hermaning, that's surprising to you. I would imagine everybody knows there were a lot of ads running for those few races.
Yeah, I think people do know the ads were running for the recall races, and maybe it's a great thing that if it was going to happen, and I think it absolutely is a repugnant process that was used, at least in this case. I think it was a bastardization of what the process was really intended to be when it was put into law, I think about 80 years ago or so, maybe 90 years ago, but maybe it's a good thing that it happened during the summer. People weren't at home. People were outside. So a lot of that spending probably wasn't very valuable, not when you look at the actual number. I think they call it points or whatever it is. You know all about that in the media. But I don't think they really got the bang for the buck that they were expecting.
John Smart, was it wasted money?
I think what's most interesting about it is where that money came from. We were all told back during the old days of the Nixon administration to follow the money. In this case, following the money is a very difficult prospect because some organizations, now the union-funded groups, had to tell where their money came from, but the Club for Growth and various other organizations on the Republican side did not have to disclose their donor list, and so people didn't know where the money was coming from, and I think that that's scary. In fact, money in politics is scary. It really is, and it's getting out of hand. It's getting totally crazy, and I think it's time that we do something about that. Senator Feingold was trying to do something about that in partnership with Senator McCain. But the Senate closed down an awful lot of the things that they were trying to do.
One place we're going to see some of that money spent next year is in the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. Tommy Thompson. Tommy Thompson filed his initial paperwork for a U.S. Senate run. John Smart, is he going to be a good candidate?
I think that Tommy Thompson would be a very good candidate. He's going to have the most problem running against other Republicans, because under the way the Republican Party is being operated these days with the people that are involved and the Tea Party folks and all of that, Tommy Thompson doesn't really extend his power that he used to have. I think he's in a difficult situation. I can understand him trying to come back and do something, but I think he probably won't succeed.
Kevin Hermaning, is Tommy Thompson's time passed as a political figure in this state?
You know, Tommy Thompson had virtually a lifetime of public service until his retirement from serving in Washington, D.C. in the Bush administration. There are a lot of Republicans who are active today who quote, came to age after Tommy Thompson was gone from the state scene. And those are the folks who are very active today and are going to be going door-to-door for other candidates other than Governor Thompson. But the real news is it's not whether Tommy Thompson is a candidate or even if he becomes the nominee of the Republican Party next year. The real news is Wisconsin is going to have a new U.S. senator next year, and it's probably not going to be a Democrat. Senator Cole is finally going to be gone, and I just can't see at all how Congresswoman Baldwin can possibly win the general election.
I have to step in and say something about Senator Cole. We should all be very, very proud of Senator Cole, and there are a lot of things that Senator Cole has done as senator from the state of Wisconsin that are not getting, never does get, the kind of attention that it might otherwise get. His position as chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Aging has been a remarkably successful venture, and I give him great credit, and I thank Senator Cole for all of his years of service. And yes, he will be very hard to replace, indeed very hard.
One more quick take. Frank emails, he'd like to hear your thoughts on a report this week that showed that workers' income has fallen 14.5% in the last 11 years in Wisconsin. Does that surprise you, Kevin Hermaning?
It surprises me that it's been over the course of 14 years, but...
11 years, 14%
years,
over
I'm sorry.
11 years.
What would be interesting is to see exactly what the length of time, how that declined in, for example, the last 2.5 years compared to the prior 8.5 years. Clearly, Wisconsin does not have the technology incubators that are very important to the future growth and healthcare growth, the rising, growing industries of this country and of the world that some of the other states do have from a competitive standpoint. And I think that's one of the reasons that Governor Walker has really made jobs as his number one priority, because we know that jobs and good quality and good high-paying jobs are really the focus as to how we're going to pull out of this recession.
I think that Kevin makes the mistake of talking about trying very hard to blame the last couple of years for what has been going on for the entire decade plus. And I think that we all are aware of the fact that we have fallen. And the distance between the poor and the very wealthy has grown immeasurably, and that is through the Bush years. And trying to make some kind of a claim that it's all been happening during Barack Obama's presidency is silly.
Give me 15 seconds each, if you would. Wisconsin's largest public workers' unions will try not to recertify. Will not try to recertify. Is that big news, John Smart?
Not really. I can understand their circumstances, and I think that they recognize that they're in a very bad position the way that the government of the state of Wisconsin is situated right now. And for
Kevin
them
Herman.
To not fight for certification makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I'm not surprised either. I've got a lot of buddies from my softball and bowling leagues who are public employees but not teachers. And I think when I heard some of the comments the other night from some of these their fellow union members, there is not a lot of love lost for what they believe the teachers' union has done to the overall workers' environment on the union side here in our state. Doesn't surprise me at all.
I have to throw in something about that, because this idea that the government of the state of Wisconsin under Scott Walker is trying to demonize the teachers, and that is simply nuts. We are so indebted to our teachers and what they do for our society and our students that I think that... Yes.
Thank you. That'll have to be the last word. We're running out of time. I do need to announce that Kirk was our winner in our Week in Review quiz. He knew that the Seattle Pilots became the Milwaukee Brewers after one failed year in Seattle in 1970. By the way, the big news of the week, the Crew has a 5-game lead over St. Louis in the National League Central with 6 games left to go. John Smart and Kevin Hermaning, thank you for joining us on the Week of Review. You probably have just enough time to say, go Brewers.
Thank you, Dean. I also have to say hello from Jim Williams in Park Falls.
Oh, hi to Jim. Well, thanks to Rob Ferret for producing our program, to Bill Martins for on-air production. Stay with us. I'm Dean Collin, back in for Joy Cardine. Joy's back on Monday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.